Hello and welcome to another episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. In this episode, I interview Dr. Douglas Tallamy, professor and chair of entomology and wildlife ecology at the University of Delaware and the author of Bringing Nature Home, How Native Plants Sustain Wildlife in Our Gardens. Dr. Tallamy's work changed my view of both what native plant means and the role of permaculture practitioners as designers in using them in the landscape. I originally began from a position that exotic and invasive plants are here, we should use them as best we can, and manage them in areas under our purview, which became instead one of, consider native plants first and foremost wherever possible, to the point of replacing non-natives and removing invasives. This change occurred because Dr. Tallamy's definition of a native plant, which starts off our interview, isn't arbitrary, and makes sense in the context of the number of relationships I seek to build in a design. The amount of diversity increases because of the insects, birds, and other creatures these plants invite into the landscape. All of that is supported by large amounts of clear evidence. You can hear some of that with a personal story from Dr. Tallamy about Carolina chickadees in his own backyard and where that research took him, as well as copious other references both throughout our conversation and within his book. In addition to native versus non-native plants and the impact they have on the environment, we also discuss the movement of flora and fauna due to climate change, invasion biology versus conservation or restoration biology, the evolutionary timeline for animals to adapt to introduced plants, which was much slower than I had expected, the role of science and education in understanding these issues, and some resources for learning more about what you can do to find out about your own native plants. As permaculture practitioners, or those with an interest in this form of regenerative design, the first place we begin our knowledge is with the ethics. First among those is earth care. As you listen to this interview and pursue more on the topics, consider that ethic and the role that native plants have on fulfilling that ethic by building a more dynamic, diverse, and stable food web for other life, and in turn, our own. However this conversation is framed, it is likely to be a contentious one. Let's work together to add to the discussion so that permaculture can continue to evolve and grow with the new knowledge and opportunities we're presented with. Join in by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com and leaving a comment for this episode. Together, we can continue to design a better world. May you enjoy this time with Dr. Tallamy as much as I did. On to the interview.
Thank you for joining me tonight, Dr. Tallamy. The reason why I wanted to reach out to you is because I found that your book was one of the most influential ones on me for changing my viewpoint on the use of natives in landscape design and in the conversation of what is a native plant. Many times when you run across definitions of native plants, they can be kind of arbitrary because it might be a particular date when a certain ship landed in the Americas and brought and those settlers brought material with them. Whereas your definition that I gleaned from your book was more about plants and animals that co-evolve together within a certain area. Do I kind of capture that right?
Yeah, that's very close to it. The definition of a native plant is really not human-driven. It's been defined by nature over many millennia based on the function of plants, the role of plants in ecosystems. They've got many roles, but one of their primary roles is to capture energy from the sun and then pass that energy on to other organisms. And if that weren't happening, we wouldn't have any other organisms because plants are the ones that do that. And the ability to pass that energy on is honed and refined through interactions with animals, and I focus on insects because they're critical in transferring energy from plants to many other groups, such as birds. And I'll just throw out one statistic. 96% of our terrestrial birds in North America rear their young on insects, so we're not going to have these birds if we don't have the insects that got their energy originally from plants. So these are really important roles that plants are performing. And humans don't get to come along and redefine them and say, well, a native plant is one that's been here since 1700 or something like that. It's nature that's defining the role. And it's all about the function of passing that energy on to other organisms. So I define natives as plants that are part of your local food web, which means if we take Colorado blue spruce, which is native to North America, it's actually native to the Colorado Rockies, and we move it to Delaware. It's still in North America, but it's outside of its local food web, so it's not performing the role that it originally performed in the Colorado Rockies. And that's how we can keep function as the core of the definition there, and then it's much easier to follow.
Now, because of what's happening with, well, as we see with the weather recently, with this hot weather that we've had, some of the reading that I've come across is that currently species are migrating like 3 times faster than normal northward. And with that migration, both of plants and animals, do you see what is currently native changing as they move?
You know, the plants in North America have moved over great distances repeatedly, particularly during the periods of glaciation. So as glaciers moved southward, the plants were pushed further south. And then as they retreated, the plants moved further north again. So you had this northward and southward migration over the cycles of glaciation a number of times. The only thing that's different now with climate change is that it's happening extremely quickly. But as plants move, so do the things that eat them. Generally, animals can move a whole lot faster than plants. So plants are the limiting factor here. I'll give you an example. The pipevine swallowtail is a specialist on pipevine Aristolochia, which historically has been found in the Appalachian mountain chain. So West Virginia, Virginia, and the higher elevations. But some years ago, it became popular in the ornamental trade, and a lot of people were planting it in their yards. And the butterfly has followed that plant. So it's the food web interaction, starting with the plant and ending with the pipevine swallowtail, and then anything that might be able to eat that, and I've seen wasps picking them off, by the way, continues, even though it's not in the range that this interaction occupied just 50 years ago.
And you see, it's that connection with the food web, so that even though the pipevine itself has moved because the specialist has moved with it, that's still
right.
a native interaction?
It's still intact, that's right. It's the interaction that is intact. Where it's occurring is different now. So when we talk about restoration ecology, a lot of people have different definitions about that. I think about restoring function, or maybe restoring is the wrong word, but maintaining function, creating diverse communities that are going to interact, that will keep as much of the biological diversity of our North American continent around as possible. It doesn't mean that's exactly what was in that place 400 years ago, or 200 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, because what has occupied any given place is extremely dynamic. It changes all the time. What it doesn't change, rapidly, though, are intercontinental movements. So we've never had plants from Asia in New Jersey before until we brought them here as ornamental. So those are such huge changes that it disrupts the interactions that used to be in New Jersey, particularly when these plants become really numerous and penetrate our natural system, which they have.
So moving something like the pipe vine or a blueberry, or even if you were moving the blue spruce that you mentioned earlier, if you're moving not just that plant but part of its community, then that's not the same kind of an introduction or an invasion of a species because of all of the components that still exist within the continent through that change. You're more concerned about intercontinental introductions, like something like kudzu.
Kudzu, yeah. I was in some suburban yards in Washington D.C. just today, surveying plants, and there are a number of those yards that had serious kudzu invasions, just from the small natural areas they have. Kudzu and porcelainberry, Ampelopsis, just taking over everything, and neither one of those plants have historically been there, and they're changing the plant biomass and the nature of the plants that can grow there dramatically. So that's the type of change I'm talking about.
Okay, so it's not necessarily just a human introduction of a plant to a region it's not originally from, but it's this really this intercontinental change because you're pulling a plant species that has never been here. And
that's right. And okay. you're not just moving the plant. You're moving the plant without its natural enemies. So the things that used to control that plant in its original continent, let's just say Asia, plus the diseases that used to keep it in check, are largely absent when you move a plant intercontinentally, which means it has an unfair advantage in competing with our native plant. There's that factor, plus the plants that do become established here. We've brought thousands of species over. Most of them do not become established or become invasive, but the ones that do are particularly good at competing. So not only are they good competitors, but they've left their natural enemies behind. So they have a competitive advantage. If they were the ecological equivalents of the native plants they're displacing, our ecosystems would look different, but functionally it wouldn't matter. They still would be just as productive. What's really unfortunate is that every time it's been examined, these plants are not the ecological equivalent, particularly in maintaining food webs. The number of creatures that can use these plants successfully is just a tiny fraction of what can use the native plant communities that used to be where these plants have now taken over.
I know throughout your book you mention a variety of specialists that their life cycle only exists because of certain plants. And I won't say that I have a great deal of knowledge about that beyond a couple of readings. But it's like the monarch butterfly uses milkweed.
Exactly.
And that's where, so then if you have something that is introduced that competes in the same ecological niche as milkweed, then the damage that does to our local bioregion is greater because it takes away not only the milkweed, but also the monarch butterflies, and then the birds then that eat that butterfly and its larva as part of their life cycle.
Right. Now, monarchs aren't a great example as bird food because milkweeds are toxic plants, essentially, and
okay.
They defend the monarch larvae very well, so birds don't rely on them heavily. But the principle is the same. 90% of the insects that eat plants are specialists, like the monarch. And you're exactly right. If you picture a field before a kudzu invasion or before a porcelain berry invasion or any of the other 3,400 species of invasive plants, you've got milkweed and you've got a variety of plant communities there. But afterwards, you have almost a monoculture of what has invaded. Autumn olive is a great example, multiflora rose. Then the milkweed's gone, or it's reduced in numbers to the point where the populations of monarchs it can support are just a fraction of what used to be supported there. And when that happens everywhere, you've got a serious problem for those plants and the things that were eating them. And that's what we're seeing.
Okay. It's a much broader view of the issue of invasion biology and the introduction of plants than what I'm familiar with, because so often it's just a matter of, well, you bring this in, well, and now it's not in a region that is where it's originally from. This discussion of a food web and functionality is much broader and more nuanced than a lot of what I run across.
I think we've fallen into a trap of because we have looked at plants as decorations or as ornaments for so long, we've forgotten about the many functions that they have. So you bring a beautiful plant from Asia in, and you know it's beautiful. Why not use it? Why not have crepe myrtle everywhere? We're talking about invasive plants, but even if it's not invasive, and crepe myrtle's a great example. I don't know of any examples where that's moving around on its own. Yet it's planted everywhere. You go to South Carolina. I mean, that is. You'd think it was the state flower, even though it's from China. So either way, it is displacing the native plant communities that used to be in our suburban our business landscapes. And it's happening over thousands and thousands of acres. So the plant doesn't have to be invasive to still replace native plants that used to be where it's planted.
So even though these plants are coming in and adding a diversity by numbers, they're not really increasing the diversity in the local bioregion because they're replacing the plants that are there. Whether or not they're invasive or not, that space that they occupy is space where a native plant could exist, which has more functions in the local ecology.
Right. If you're going to measure diversity, you have to measure more than the diversity of plants, more than the number of species of plants you have in your landscape. Because it's quite true that if we have a well-planted garden, you can have hundreds of species from someplace else, which means the species richness of that area is greater than if you go to the nearby woodlot and start counting species. But if you count the things that are using those plants, that's when the numbers really fall off. For example, the genus Quercus, our oaks in the mid-Atlantic states, support 534 species of caterpillars. If you removed oaks from your yard, you were potentially removing 534 species of caterpillars that nobody ever pays attention to. They, you know, they don't know they're there, but they're vital in terms of supporting local wildlife. An example that I just ran across this spring when I was watching Carolina chickadees feed their young in my yard. I was trying to get pictures of things like that. And, I did some calculations looking at the number of caterpillars they were bringing back, the spacing between foraging flights. And then I looked in the literature, and it was all confirmed. They bring back about 300 caterpillars a day when they're feeding their young, and they feed their young for 16 days. So if you add that up, that's 4,800 caterpillars to feed one clutch of chickadees. If you have Zelkova as your major tree in your yard, and I was in yards in D.C. today where that is the only tree that's there, you have zero caterpillars because none of our North American caterpillars can eat them, which means you're not going to be able to have any birds supported by that tree. If you have one Zelkova and 15 oaks, it'd probably be okay. But when everything is a Zelkova or a ginkgo or a crepe myrtle or a burning bush or all these other things that don't support any insect diversity, the birds that rely on those insects are simply going to be gone. Insects just don't appear out of nowhere. They need the proper host plant.
Your little statistic about the chickadees answers so many questions about why I have so many in my backyard. My family feeds the birds over the winter, and it serves as a great educational platform for my children as the different birds come in and we can discuss which ones are normally here, what seasons they come through. But we have a lot of chickadees every year, but right outside I have a very, very large oak right next to where we feed them, so that brings it together.
That's a good point. Chickadees eat seeds most of their life, but when they're rearing their offspring, it's caterpillars. So I watch these chickadees, I watch them during their entire period of reproduction, and the only thing they brought back was caterpillars. There weren't crickets, there weren't grasshoppers or other things in there. And I didn't realize, when I say birds eat insects, they usually eat a lot of different types of insects. But some are really specific, and chickadees, it turns out, are specific on caterpillars. All of our warblers favor caterpillars. So this connection between Lepidoptera, the moths and butterflies that make those caterpillars, and the health of our bird communities is a really tight one. It's a really important one, particularly in the East here. So even though you're feeding birds your seeds all winter long, don't think that you can just put out seeds and they'll rear their young in the seeds, because the young can't eat seeds. It's only 5% of our birds where young can actually develop on seeds. Our finches and doves can develop on seeds, but the rest of them need those insects and the spiders that eat insects. So we can't forget those when we're building landscapes.
And this is the first year that I've really just allowed my yard to be as much of a natural meadow as possible in order to watch the succession occur from this kind of artificial grassland that we have to try to reforest the area. I've just been letting it go. And I know that this year I've probably seen 10 times as many different types of spiders, caterpillars, insects, ranging from not much bigger than like the eraser on the size of a pencil to things that are the size of my finger. And it's very different to see how much how much change can occur in just a year.
But you know how fast birds will find a bird's a feeder when you put it out. As soon as they come across it in their back, and they'll just keep coming back until the seed is gone. That's exactly what you're doing with your landscape. You've created a giant bird feeder. So those birds will be there, and they'll be taking advantage of that the entire time. And then, of course, you get to take advantage of the birds. You get to see them. It's an enriching experience.
I just wish that they would...
That's why I keep trying to get people to think of landscape plants as big bird feeders. And some plants are much better bird feeders than other plants.
I'm finding that my blueberry and my elder are my favorite bird feeders this season. So,
great.
Yeah. 2 days away from going out with my children to harvest the blueberries, and we come back the next day to see a bird take off the last one.
Yeah. You have to plant more blueberries.
Yes. Though, this is just a question for my garden, and then we'll return to this conversation. Do you know what eats saddleback caterpillars?
Well, the answer is no, I don't know.
Okay.
I do know that a lot of birds will take caterpillars that have stinging spines and defenses like that with their beak. Of course, their beak is tough, and they just slam them on the twigs. They bang them around until they're dead, and then they eat them. I've never seen that with a saddleback, so I can't tell you that's happening for sure.
Okay.
But being defended doesn't mean it works all the time.
Okay. I had the misfortune of being stung by one. They really seem to be attracted to my blueberries. That's where I find most of them.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know if you've ever been stung by one, but it was the most unpleasant thing that I've ever experienced from a sting or a bite. I couldn't believe it.
I have. You brush up against them with your arm, and you always brush up first before you see them. So
yeah.
Yeah, it gets your attention.
Yeah, I thought it was a broken twig on the blueberry that I just scraped myself.
Uh-huh.
And then, yeah, a couple seconds later, that burning starts. Like, what is this?
Yep.
So
yeah.
I'll have to check the literature and see if I can find out what eats them and what I can do to introduce their predators in.
Right.
So,
I do know what eats them. A lot of parasitic insects eat them. There are parasitic flies in the family Tachinidae, and I have... If you go out and collect a whole bunch of saddlebacks, at least half of them will be parasitized. And then, of course, those flies emerge, and they're not stinging at all, and a lot of things can eat them. And then a number of parasitic wasps get them as well. So all of those caterpillars are vulnerable to parasitic insects.
Okay. Well, that's another way for me to go about that. I know that I have some parasitic wasps here. I've seen quite a few of the tomato caterpillars
right,
that have
right.
The little
braconids on them, yeah.
Yeah. So, but before we go too far afield and I start asking you all my gardening questions, one of the things that we talked about before we started the interview was about some of the invasion biology literature. And one book in particular that comes up in the permaculture literature quite a lot and in conversations, because I know that it came up in my permaculture design course, there's a series of books that are very popular, called Edible Forest Gardens, and this book is mentioned, is Invasion Biology, Critique of a Pseudoscience by Dr. David Theodoropoulos. And I was wondering if you could comment some on that book and your viewpoint on some of the critiques of invasion biology.
I have one major critique of invasion biology and people who are making the claim that, you know, we have an awful lot of alien plants that are here. We're never going to get rid of them. Therefore, we shouldn't try. We shouldn't invest any money in it because it's a losing venture. What I really object to is being told why I don't like these invasive plants. And I've been told lots of reasons. One of them is that I don't like alien people. Therefore, I don't like alien plants. It's called nativism. Of course, it's not true. That I want to return the world to the way it was pre-Gadate. You know, that I miss the old way, and I just want to return to the old way. A lot of anthropological reasoning about why I don't like invasive species, none of which are correct in my case. I can tell you exactly why I don't like them. I don't like them because they destroy ecosystem function. And I like diversity. I like to see these animals in my yard. I have been to invaded habitats. I live in invaded habitats. And believe me, they are depauperate compared to what they were before invasion. Why that could be considered better, one of the lines in these books is we should embrace them. Why I should embrace a depauperate biosphere is beyond me. Particularly, what gets me is why we have these species here to begin with. 85% of our woody invasive plants were brought in for the ornamental industry. We lost our American chestnut, plant that dominated the mountains as a forest tree from Maine all the way to Florida, so that we could see what Japanese chestnut looked like in our front yard. I just don't think these are good reasons to be wiping out North American diversity. And then tell me to embrace it. That's what gets me. What's missing, my primary criticism of the books that are telling us to embrace all these novel ecosystems, is the fact that they are none of them are discussing food web function and the crash of food webs when these things invade. And, in part, much of that research is brand new. It's just coming out. I'm publishing regularly on it, and there hasn't been a lot on it. So some of these books were written before anything was published. So right? It's not their fault for missing something if it wasn't out in the literature. But ignoring, some of these books are written by botanists, and ignoring the role, the primary role of plants in terms of ecosystem function, and that is supporting these food webs, is a grave oversight and actually needs to be addressed. If somebody can tell me that these invasive plants are supporting the diversity of the native plant communities that they're replacing, okay, then I'm with it. I'm not going to fight it. I won't spend another dime, and I can still go out and collect all the things I used to collect, and I can have the bird diversity, and everybody will be happy. But of course, that's not going to happen because that's not the way it is in nature.
You understand the dynamic nature, of biology, of all these food webs and everything else, that they are going to change, that nothing is static, which I think is one of the common ideas is that, well, nature's out there and we can just leave it be because it'll be okay.
Right.
With this kind of idea that it just is the way that it is and is unchanging.
And, but, you know, in the long term, they are correct. It's going to sort itself out, but it will sort itself out over evolutionary time. The plants that are now in North America that used to be in Asia will have new insect herbivores adapt to them, and then food webs will slowly be restored. But how long is this going to take, and what will go extinct in the meantime? I can give you some examples of how slowly it's going. The common reed, Phragmites, which has the invasive form of Phragmites that has now penetrated our wetlands up and down the East Coast in the Great Lakes region and so on, is a genotype from Europe, where in Europe it supports, I think it's 156 species of insects. So it's a vibrant member of European plant communities. Over here, and it has been here for 400 years, it supports five, which means only five of our insects have been able to use that, adapt it as a host plant. And those five were already grass specialists. So they had the physiological ability to eat Phragmites and not die. So that's great. That's a good start. But five and 400 years, this is going to take hundreds of thousands of years to develop the same community that occurs on Phragmites over in Europe. So if the problem here is we're bringing so many plants over so quickly, primarily so we can see what they look like in our gardens, and then they escape, and they're in our natural areas changing everything, that the rate of change is far at passing the rate at which our animals can adapt to these changes. Plants do move around. They have moved around over evolutionary time, but it typically happens very, very slowly. So it's the rate of change which is the problem here, not change itself. So your original statement that, I don't want to go back the way it was is correct. The biggest change, of course, is that humans are here now. We are part of the ecosystem. I am not proposing that we go away, but I am proposing that we share the human-dominated ecosystems where we live, our neighborhoods, our corporate landscapes, even our agriculture, that we share those spaces with other living things because we need those living things to run the ecosystems that produce the ecosystem services that we humans depend on. So it's a selfish sharing that I'm talking about. We absolutely cannot allow this extinction crisis that we're looking at to continue because those are the organisms that keep our ecosystems running. Just one quick example would be pollinators. 80% of our plants are pollinated by animals, not by the wind. Only 20% are pollinated by the wind. If we lose those animals, we lose 80% of our plants. Everybody, we are doing that. We are wiping out our pollinators because we're not paying attention to what they need in terms of the plants that they pollinate and in terms of the places where they build their nests. So it's a matter of just thinking everything's going to continue on as is. Of course, if you pave an area over, all the plants are gone. So all the diversity they supported are gone. And we do that, every day more and more and more. So we need to be much better at sharing our landscapes with the things that used to live there.
This has generated several different thoughts for me in all this. Part of it is that I wish I could remember the name of it, but there was a documentary that I saw a year or two ago that showed what happened in a region of, I believe it was China, after they introduced a particular insecticide that they were using in order to grow citrus better. But they didn't realize that this insecticide was also slowly killing off their pollinators. And they were left without any, and then they showed what had happened to this industry later, and it's all these individuals walking around with just a bundle of like cotton swabs as they walk up, and it's a person reaching into the flower with the swab, swabbing it around, turning the end over, swabbing it with the other end, and passing this pollen from tree to tree to tree, and it's just this like army of people moving through this valley, hand pollinating all of this because they destroyed the creatures that were doing it before. And
It's a good example. It's a good example. Pollination is a vital ecosystem service.
And you mentioned earlier about how quickly birds find bird feeders. One of the things for me as I look at garden design, both in my individual yard and trying to share the idea of doing, if you will, restoration gardening with my neighbors, can we do, like, if you will, habitat islands in our yards in order to bring these species in and to give them host plants and whatnot? Or do we need larger areas of uninterrupted like meadows and fields to serve that role? Or can we do it in suburbia with, you know, a 5-foot round here, a 10-by-20 bed there? Would that be enough to help this process?
That's the million-dollar question right now. Nobody has done the research to examine that question. I can give you a few anecdotes that suggest we can do it. Of course, the more land we share, the easier it's going to be. The more connectivity there is, the easier it's going to be. I can talk about connectivity for a long time, but a real easy way to build connectivity into our suburban and agricultural landscapes is to use riparian carters, the plants that ought to be along every stream and river in this country. That immediately connects things in a continuous way, so they're not broken by miles of uninhabitable land. It also protects these waterways from all of the nasties that we want to keep out of the water. If you've got well-vegetated stream size and riparian areas along the rivers, all those fertilizer runoff that we have from our agriculture areas and our giant lawns is going to be absorbed before it gets into the streams. We're going to increase infiltration. I mean, there's all kinds of things that are going to come out of that, and all of them are good. We won't be building in our flood zones any longer. It's a silly place to be building. So that's one way we can build connectivity. But the anecdote I was talking about is comes from a group at the Department of Agriculture in Dover, Delaware. There's a courtyard in that building, and so the courtyard is essentially surrounded by this Department of Ag building in Dover, Delaware, which is the capital of Delaware, so it's a city. And some of the folks that work there wanted to do a study that looked at native bees that were remaining in Dover. So they wanted to plant a garden to see which bees came in. That was the focus of the study. Well, one of the things, and they planted flowering plants that bees would like. One of the things that they planted were milkweeds, common milkweeds. This was a small garden. It was 15 by 15 feet. And in the very first year that they planted it, it takes a while for gardens to get established. But one of the young ladies who worked there decided she would count the number of monarch butterflies that developed from egg to adult on those milkweed plants, which was just a portion of this small garden in that first year of planting. And it turned out to be 150 of them. So it's just an astounding number. Of producing an insect in a very small space in the middle of a city that really has very little connectivity. Now, it's true that monarchs are highly mobile. They can get around. They can find these small patches, and everything is not as mobile as that. But I would say we all should get started, and as we start to fill in these spaces, they'll become more and more connected. But don't shy away. Don't say, well, I can't connect with a national park, so I'm not going to do anything. Because you might be able to connect with something your neighbor is doing, and it could help some creature that you haven't even thought of. And I'm seeing this at my own yard. We own 10 acres here that was mowed for hay, so there was nothing here really. The mower had taken it all away, and we're essentially rebuilding a forest. We're in the kind of the late scrub stage now. Most of the trees we planted are about 20 feet tall, but the diversity of things that have come in is just amazing. We've got I've got a fair amount of grass. It still takes me more than an hour to mow the trails and the front part. Because lawn is a perfect thing for moving through your landscape. You can walk on that plant without killing it. So I'm not suggesting we get rid of all of our lawn. I am suggesting that we cut it way down. We've got 45.6 million acres of lawn in the U.S., and we just don't need them. It has become the default landscaping. We're tired of planting plants. Everything else becomes lawn. And then we suffer from its poor water management. It overloads the landscape with nutrients and pesticides. And lawn, of course, is cool season European grasses, and it's just a very small amount of the plant biomass that used to be in those areas. So we need to get more plants back into the landscape to build these islands that you were talking about.
You mentioned about building riparian corridors, and I happen to live on a very nice trout stream not far from the Susquehanna. And some of my neighbors are looking to do repair along the stream here. Do you happen to know offhand what the current recommended width is for a riparian corridor, kind of as a minimum?
You know, I think recommended for what is the question? I think if you're looking for agricultural recommendations, it's not much.
Okay.
It may be as little as 20 feet on either side. The folks at the Stroudwater Research Center in Avondale, Pennsylvania, have been looking at that question for decades, and they have an answer. If you want to have healthy aquatic systems, what you need is shade over those aquatic systems, because it lowers the water temperature to the point where the insects that build those healthy systems can survive. And in order to have shade, of course, you have to have trees overhanging those streams. So they would tell you that is the number one thing you have to do. Those trees also drop their leaves into the streams, and that is what those aquatic insects eat. They're shredders. They eat that leaf detritus. And then you get the predators that feed on them, and then you get the trout that feed on them. And I learned an interesting factoid from the Pacific Northwest just a few weeks ago. I was up there giving a talk. And it turns out that I think it's 60% of the insect protein that young salmon eat that they get comes from terrestrial insects that fall into the stream as opposed to aquatic insects. And, you know, I was blown away by that. But that means, if that's true, and that's what the studies say, you've got to have the native plants making those insects that will fall into the stream. If you've got an invasion by Asian blackberries, which they have a terrible invasion with up there in Oregon and Washington and Alaska, you're not going to get those insects falling into the stream. So you've just taken away 60% of the food that these salmon need. Is that true in the eastern streams with trout? I don't know. But shading our streams is the number one thing that we should do. And if we got all the streams shaded, then broadening the corridor is only going to be a good thing. But at least having enough trees to shade the stream would be the primary goal.
Okay, that goes back to some of what I had read before, and I know that the where I am, the trout fishermen are largely fly fishermen, and all the tree cover makes them swear heavily.
Yeah.
Because they're coming in with those very long rods that are made more for a large open river. So I always kind of chuckle as I walk back there with my 6.5-foot rod and let them know what's going on. I'll need to see if I can contact that research center, but the number that you mentioned...
Contact Bern Sweeney.
Bern Sweeney?
At the Stroudwater Research Center, and he will be happy to tell you.
Okay. No, that's good, because the numbers that I had read were also very small, like between 25 and 50 feet. But when these questions come up because of wanting to preserve lawn, but at the same time wanting to protect the stream, as some of the numbers that are out there, they go, oh, but I'm going to lose too much grass, and I don't like the way that looks. And it's like, well, let's see what this number is to match the research so that we can all go away satisfied.
You know what people really want is the view. So they're afraid if they don't have lawn, they'll lose their view of their aquatic system, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But you can maintain that view, at least in portions of your area, with meadow. It doesn't have to be lawn. It could be functional meadow, which is really good at absorbing nutrients. And, of course, you're not fertilizing a meadow, so it's not going to run right down to the stream. Mm-hmm. But I like to talk about viewing wedges, framing the view. So you say, here's a particularly beautiful part of the stream or river I want to frame, and then frame it with large trees. So you don't have to have everything tree-lined, but frame it with large trees, and you have reduced the amount of open area tremendously, and you still get to maintain your view. So, it's compromise. It's ecological compromise that we're absolutely going to have to do if we want to maintain.
so that we as human beings can still get the beauty and the function out of it that we want, whether that's a play area for our children, a relaxing place to sit, but in the same way, to use our ability to design the world around us to function not only for ourselves, but also for nature.
Yeah. I can't stress that too much. Every time we add a new human to the planet, we're doing that once every 6 seconds. We need more ecosystem services rather than fewer. But the way we're treating our landscapes now, every time we add a human, we're getting fewer ecosystem services. So, you know, most of us are realizing now that the planet really is finite. I was just thinking about this the other day. If I tried to convince somebody that the moon was finite, that it really wasn't that big a place, its resources were limited, we'd all get that because the moon has always looked like a little white dot in the sky to us. But when you try to convince somebody that the Earth is limited, that's much harder to grasp because no matter where we go, it seems just as big. The horizon is still just as far away. But it's just this little speck in the sky floating around. And we cannot continue to grow forever because the planet is not growing. It's just that simple.
I had it once described to me that the only thing that we know of that will grow forever is cancer, and that kills you. But as you say, looking out at that little dot that's the moon, it's only been within the last a little over 50 years now that humanity has even seen what the planet looks like not even a whole, but only the face that we could see from space. And even those iconic pictures don't really bring it home for us because so many of us have never a handful of people across the world from all these space programs, only a couple of handful of people have ever actually experienced that.
But that's a good point. That shot of Earth from the moon, one of those moon missions, is cited as being one of the turning points where people actually got it, said, look, there it is, and it's not getting any bigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how do we continue to raise that awareness with everything?
Well, I talk about education. I mean, education's really important. We're not born with this knowledge. We've got to pass it along. We've learned a whole lot over the last 100 years. But we've got to value education, and we've got to stop viewing science as some kind of conspiracy. I don't know what's a conspiracy for, but and not be afraid of new knowledge. Denial is denial of anything is just not a healthy approach to life, and it tends to come back and bite us. So I'd say education is the key.
To continue to educate ourselves, each other, explore, and have those tough conversations and the fights with your colleagues over this kind of
right,
conversation so that you can continue to expand the base of knowledge. And even though I had a professor in college who, for geology, who remembered when plate tectonics was a new idea.
That's right.
And I grew up with it as an accepted idea for years and years and years. You know, that's the only thing that I've ever known. But here was an individual who had experienced science as it changed. And even though we may have a certain prevailing model now, it may change. And the great thing about science is that the new evidence means that because we question and explore, our viewpoint changes with that evidence. It doesn't stay static. It is dynamic as new ideas are presented.
That is what science is. It's hypothesis testing. Somebody has an idea. We test it. There's evidence for it. There may be evidence against it. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say, oh, something's just a theory. What they really mean is it's just a hypothesis. By the time it reaches theory status, it has been tested thousands of times, and you get the same result. So you say, well, it looks like this is the way it is. You know, it doesn't make it ironclad. We always learn new things. But when you have thousands of independent experiments all coming up with the same answer, it's a good idea to go with it. It really is. What's curious to me is we don't question other forms of our society. In terms of cultural wisdom. So for example, if our car breaks down, we don't say, now should I take this to the dentist or should I take the car to the mechanic? Right away, we know the mechanic is the guy and we're going to trust whatever he does, and that's what we do. But curiously today, you know, if scientists say, hey, this is happening, who do we turn to? We turn to our politicians or our economists or the local oil man, but the scientist is not trusted at all, and that's just curious to me.
Well, there was a conversation with the ethicist Don Brown. I don't remember what school he teaches at. But in that conversation, he was talking about climate change, from an ethical viewpoint. But in that, he had a critic against that point, and he's like, look, you know, there are people who spend their lives doing this who are smarter than me. That this is their specialty, so I'm going to trust them to tell me this. And I know that I can go in, you know, the doctor example or even the mechanic. My car breaks down, I may have an idea of what's wrong. And I go in and I say, well, these are the symptoms that led up to this breakdown. Or if I go see my doctor, you know, these are my symptoms and I think it might be this because I had a problem with it before. Well, let's look into this. And then, you know, it may take some tinkering or you replace a part and you find out that wasn't it. But we narrow down the knowledge until we can solve the problem. And with science, I mean, we have so much potential and so much information that we can use that we may not be able to say, just flip a switch and fix the problem, or, you know, here's a prescription for something. But we have the knowledge and the means to, at least, as, you know, we're discussing here, the riparian corridors and building islands of habitat, that there's evidence there that it's a start. And we can continue to adapt to that.
These are complex issues that have complex answers. They're not simple yes and no answers. Nothing is black and white. You know, gray rules the day these days. So it takes a lot of sophisticated experiments and lots of people independently working on these things and discussions like you and I are having right now over periods of time. Your example of plate tectonics is a great one. It was at least 20 years before that gained even some semblance of acceptance. That was a hugely important idea. So we'll sort it out in the end. I just hope we do it in time.
Yeah. Well, it's as you said, you know what it would take to change your mind, and you're clear about that. And I think that's for any of us who are going to question anything and say, well, you know, I don't necessarily believe your viewpoint. Well, what would it take for you to view that that way? Because then we can go to the literature, we can go to the research and see, well, is it out there or can we find it?
Right.
And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you is because of the conversation about invasion biology is a big one. And the idea of what natives are and what is not native, and, you know, being able to find evidence 40,000 years ago in California that there was a eucalypt forest there. But that doesn't necessarily apply 40,000 years later. And as our own lives and knowledge change, we need to be able to change with that. And I really like the amount of information that your book provides and that this conversation has given me, with examples of what a native is based on function. And I look at this when you talked about the Phragmites, that in Europe they support 156 species, but in the U.S. they support 5. And I can almost hear it in the back of my head that you're having a conversation with someone about Phragmites, and someone points to those 5 species as an example of why it's okay to have it there.
Exactly.
Because as soon as you say, but in Europe it supports, right, but here it is in the United States, and these are the 5 that are already here. But it's taken 400 years for that to happen.
And the real comparison is, what did that Phragmites displace, and what were those plants supporting? Because that's the real comparison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
5 species of insects is a pretty depauperate community, I can tell you. And I know the insects that, you know, that are on there. There's an otitid fly. There are a few scales. These are tiny little members of the herbivore community. They're not passing on a whole lot of energy to higher trophic levels. So. No, they're there. They're important. They're a good start. There's actually a skipper, I believe, a skipper butterfly that uses it. Just a few species compared to what used to be there.
And that's going to continue to happen the more that we introduce these things from these outside systems. Or, as you say, if we're not out there actually combating the ones that have already been released in order to reduce that space.
That's a tough problem because, you know, the critics are absolutely right. These species are here. They are here by the zillion. We continue to buy them and sell them in our nurseries and plant them everywhere. It does seem to be an overwhelming problem. So I'd address that in two ways. I would say, is it wise to continue selling them? There really are alternatives that we should be looking at. Many of us, not all of us, but many of us are landowners. I think in Delaware, 80, 85% of the land is privately owned. If every landowner addressed the problem on his or her land and didn't worry about anything else, we'd go a long way towards combating these things. It's not going to be easy. Believe me, we do it here at home all the time, and it is not easy. You have to be vigilant. but there's this huge rain of seeds that come down every year from the plants that other people are not controlling or are still planting. So we continually have to combat these new plants that have invaded the seed. If people started to control these things, particularly get the large mature plants that are making the seeds out of the seed, there'll be far fewer seeds. And then the rain of seeds and the invasion will slow. It really will. So I am hopeful, but it's got to be a community effort that we all address. The big problem, of course, are the public lands. Who's going to pay for all of that? And that's why I get so upset when I hear arguments about, embracing these things. And, if you say embrace a species from someplace else, what you're really saying is I encourage the sale of this species from someplace else. And, that really does seem pretty hopeless. If you've got half the society bringing in these things, you get my gist.
Yes. Well, as you said, education is important. And that's really one of the first places we can start is to recognize the impact that this has. And one of the conversations that we have in permaculture a lot is looking at the relationships between things and looking at yields and how you can stack functions within a space and how things are related. And I think that this conversation with you gives some numbers to relate to things, because we go from an oak tree that supports 534 different species to something else that may be very functional for a human being, that body of one. But by making that choice, then we take out a lot of other species in the process. And if we're going to support the ethics of permaculture, which these days are known as earth care, people care, and fair shares, that earth care is the first one for a reason, and that we have to take care of not only ourselves, but the other species that are there. And this is a really important lesson, I think, for myself and a lot of others, to really have some numbers and information to go with that and understand how much happens because of it. So, and of course, I'm not going to tell anybody that no, you shouldn't plant your tomatoes or anything else.
That's right. We're not talking about a trade-off between the agricultural plants we rely on. We rely on them. We need them.
Right.
But it doesn't have to be either or. I do believe it can be both. Not in the same place, but. Again, I come back to all that unused space that we have out there. And I always focus in on the lawn, because there's so many acres that are just barren that could be used productively, if not for agricultural reasons, but to support the biodiversity that we need. If we're willing to sacrifice that area just so that we have this viewscape of green grass, that's not good stewardship. And it suggests that we really do have unlimited resources. Well, we don't have unlimited resources, and it's pretty easy to convince people of that. So I think that's a value. It's, the lawn has become a status symbol that we have pursued over the last century. It has represented wealth. It's actually represented good land stewardship. If you don't take care of your lawn, then you're a communist, you're not a good guy, all of that. So, maybe the new status symbol can be how many hummingbirds you have in your yard this year. It shows you're being a good steward of the land. You're sharing your land with other things, as opposed to just painting this static, dead landscape. It might as well be a postcard on the wall.
Well, and I think myself and other people who are out there doing this kind of work, whether they're practicing permaculture or some other kind of sustainable design, we can go a long way to show people that this can be beautiful, that it can be functional, and we can do that with these species. And there's just for the listeners, there's a link that I'm going to put up in the show notes. There's a company in Pennsylvania, Ernst Conservation Seeds,
right,
that has a ton of great things if you're in the United States. I don't know how they do it for the international, but you can go there and you can just go to their search list and type look for a species type, where it's native or naturalized, whether it's a wetland, all kinds of great things. Search by color and go and buy some great seeds. And they're someone who I'm looking to buy some stuff from for some repair where I am. So
right. I'll plug the Ernst as well. I know them. They're a family business. They do a great job. And I don't think they do anything international. They focus largely on Pennsylvania seed stock. So they're not entirely, but largely. So their provenance is good. When you get something from Ernst, that's going to do well in Pennsylvania.
That's good. And I'll have to contact them and see if they know or work with any other conservation seed companies if they refer customers so that I can get a larger list of people to work with.
I think they know them all.
Okay.
Well, there are a number of people in the Midwest, prairie nurseries and prairie nurseries. But Ernst is the closest one in terms of providing local provenance.
Okay. Then you'll have to reach out to them and see what they can let me know about. But I'm looking at the time and how long that I've had you here. So I don't want to keep you for the rest of your night. You should have some time to enjoy yourself before you're back off to teach classes. For those of us who are here in the eastern United States, where the bulk of your book focused when it came to species to plant and natives, what would be 5 plants that you would recommend to someone to bring into their backyard if they're from this area?
You know, this area was with us once almost continuous forest. So I think that's what I would suggest is that you plant the most productive trees that once thrived in our areas. We have ranked them with our research in terms of their ability to make food for other organisms, particularly birds. And oaks are number one. The genus Prunus, so black cherries and chip cherries and American plum, that's number two. They support 456 species. Number three are our native willows. We have dozens of species. It's highly productive. I believe poplars are number four, birches number five. So there'd be my top five.
Okay. And one last question then is, are there, beyond your book, which I have to plug because it was great, it really did change my viewpoint on all of this, given all the material that I'd read before, that would go against the idea of natives in this way. What other resources, be they books or websites or anything, would you recommend for people to go check out if they'd like more information about native species, their role in the food web?
There are lots of books on native plants. Many of them are they're encyclopedic in terms of here's the plant and this, what it does. This is where you get it. Bill Kalina's books, and he has 4 or 5 of them at this point, are all great places to start. I don't know of a lot of other books that are approaching it from the food web perspective, because as I said, this is new. We're really just starting to think about this. But in terms, a lot of people say, where can I get these native plants? And where should I plant them? Just because it's native doesn't mean it's going to work where you are. Plants like acidic soil, like basic soil, plants like wet, they like dry. You've got to put it in the right place, whether or not it comes from the land. So that information is all in these other books. But go ask the Google. What are the native plants in my area, and get all kinds of resources and locations for where to buy them.
Okay, that's great.
Don't get on starting small, starting from seed. I have dozens of oaks that are in our property, dozens, and most of which we started from acorn, which of course are free. And I'm talking about white oaks that are now 15 feet tall, and that's taken 11 years. So, it's not a 300-year-old oak, but it's a functional plant. If I always tell people you can get instant gratification from your oaks if you call them oak bushes. But right away, they start to support that 534 species of caterpillars and birds are all over them. And they grow every year. And you enjoy the process that is bringing nature back into your life. So don't be afraid to go ahead and collect seeds of all of these things. And your biggest challenge these days with our over abundance of deer is to protect them from deer browsers. So you have to put little wire cages around them until they get big enough. But it's all possible and it works. And I know that because we're doing that right here at home.
That's great. That's awesome, Dr. Talamy. Thank you very much for all of this information, for all of your time. I can't wait to sit down.
I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I'll put this all together and let you know when it's done.
Okay.
So thank you very much for your time.
All right, thanks.
Thank you for joining me for another interview. If you have comments or questions about this or any other episode, go to thepermaculturepodcast.com and leave a message or send me an email. That address is show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Until the next time, take care of yourself, the earth, and each other.